Thanks, Mark. And Mark, thanks a lot for all the work that you did. I've put these things together myself. I know they're a huge amount of work, and thank you for your service. My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic. I'm really glad to be here. My friend Robert John is also part of this thing. But I'm really glad to be here with my buddies Rich and Doug. Doug, the first time I met him, Doug is kind of a workaholic too. He hasn't really admitted his issue there yet. But the first time I met Doug was in Charlottesville, Virginia. I was doing a workshop down there, and Doug came to it. And he brought his laptop, and he was the only guy in the workshop sitting there typing away on the laptop while we were doing the workshop. And I knew anybody bizarre enough to do something like that would be very, very cool guy. And he's become an incredibly good friend of mine. Rich I met, I actually met him in Nova Scotia at one of the things that I was doing. I'd heard about him for a while, but we first met up there. And he was going to be I forget which speaker. It was a Sunday morning spiritual speaker or something. And he had the room across the hall from me. They put us up in this hotel. And I was thinking, man, this guy is really spiritual because he's doing this chanting. He was chanting. He must be preparing for his talk the next day. I talked to him the next day. He had food poisoning. He was vomiting. That's what I heard. That's what I heard through the walls. He's like, whoa. It sounded like chanting to me. I'll tell you, he was white as a ghost, and he kicked it. He did a great talk that morning. But it's always a pleasure to do these things. Mark was talking about the lie detector test. Any one of us could have passed the lie detector test at one point in time or another when we said we were done. I'm never going to drink again. I never want to go through this again. This was a horrible experience. I'm tired of feeling this bad. You know how bad alcohol made you feel. For whatever kind of fun you had, even if it was fun, it was never worth that horrible feeling in the morning. And for the last 2 years of my drinking, that's exactly what it was like. I would swear to God in the morning I would never do this again. And slowly throughout the day, what would happen is, I would fortify myself up with food and liquid. And then I would say to myself, that decision that I made this morning, I'm gonna have to modify that. That's an overreaction, Now, here's the thing about alcoholism. Alcoholism is an unorthodox illness. It is misunderstood by at least 90% of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous in this country. It's misunderstood by. It's misunderstood by probably 80% of the people that treat you for it. When you pay to go to a treatment center or a detox or something, they don't understand it. It's a very, very difficult illness. It's unorthodox. It presents in really weird ways. And unless you've actually experienced alcoholism and experienced recovery, you're not going to really understand it because it's just so unorthodox. One of the things that happens with the alcoholic is you start to break down as far as your liver and pancreas. Your body's ability to metabolize alcohol breaks down and something goes wrong with the plumbing. Okay, and instead of going down the pipe that it goes down with Aunt Fanny and Uncle Fudd, it goes down a different pipe with us, and something different happens to us. And what that is that's the phenomenon of craving. Has anybody in here sworn they were going to only go out for two, and then you close the bar? Okay, that's an example of the phenomenon of craving. Once you start, here's what happens. The first drink always does one thing. It insists on the second drink. The second drink demands the third drink. And by the time you've had your 14th drink, you wanted that more than you wanted your 13th. Because the more alcohol in your body, the more it causes the craving for more alcohol. It's physiological. That's fairly easy to understand. Most people in AA understand that one. Most treatment professionals understand that one. The really, really tricky part of alcoholism, though, is the obsession of the mind. There's a great line in the 12 and 12 in step one. It says, who among us wishes to admit complete defeat? Glass in hand, we've warped our minds to such a state that only an act of divine providence can relieve us of our obsession. That's a beautiful sentence. But do you know what it means? It means we're in real trouble. It means if God doesn't shine down out of the clouds on top of us, we're dead. That's not good news, and who wants to admit something like that? You know, my first experience with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't stay sober, but my first experience was this. I thought that AA was a place to remind me to want to not drink. The more I go to AA, the more I'll remember it's a bad idea to drink. So I'm going to AA because that'll keep my memory green. And that's how I approached Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, the obsession of the mind, it says in the big book, at certain times, you are not going to have access to power, choice, and control in drink. You're not going to have access to it. So no matter how much you don't want to drink, no matter what the consequences are going to be, no matter how many decisions you made or solemn oaths that you swore on the Bible, that's not going to protect you from the next drink. Nothing, no human power can protect you from the next drink. Now, you know, when I first came into AA, I thought I just needed to be convinced. I thought AA was like a big pep rally. Yay, yay, we don't drink today, you know? And we go into a huddle and we keep it simple and we first things first and okay, we'll see you back here tomorrow night at the discussion meeting break, you know? And that's what I thought Alcoholics Anonymous was. Now, that worked really well until the day it didn't. Okay? And I was on my way to an AA meeting, you know, I'm in AA. You got to understand, I signed myself into a treatment center. Okay, I wasn't forced in there. I was the only person in this treatment center that signed myself voluntarily in there. You know, there's a great line in the big book. We take voluntary commitments at asylums, you know. Well, who else, like, voluntarily signs himself into the asylum? Well, I'm going to Happy Hills, you know. Be back in 28. I mean, you know, So I'm on my way to an AA meeting, and I'd done 28-day rehab. I was in outpatient, and I was going to AA meetings, all because I thought I was going to die. This wasn't because I was in a jackpot or something. What had happened is my slow deterioration, it got to the point where I really thought I was losing my mind. I mean, I've wrecked 9 cars in drunken car wrecks, okay? Blackout car wrecks, 9 of them. I was killed in one accident. You know, I mean, 3 DUIs, lost a family. Had like 13 jobs in 10 years. You know, I mean, living with mom. You know, I'm there with you, Rich. And it was awful. And I really started to think I was losing my mind. So I was serious about this stuff. I am telling you, the AA meetings that I was going to, no one wanted to stay away from booze more than me in those meetings. Nobody. I guarantee it. And on the way to an AA meeting, the thought crosses my mind, and this is what I thought. You know, I haven't been drunk in, you know, like 80 days. You know, I don't even really remember what it's like. I know. I'll buy a gallon of vodka and I'll drink it. And what that'll do is it'll make me feel so bad, I'm going to really do this AA stuff well. So I bought a gallon of vodka and drank it to improve my sobriety. This was a mistake. Here's what happened. I'm like, good idea, good idea. Second drink, good idea, good idea. Third drink, oh my God, what have I done? I've opened up the cage door to the beast. He's going to roll me around like a puppet for however long it's going to be, you know. Oh, I can't believe I was this stupid. in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about sometimes we do this and we're pounding on the bar asking ourselves, how could we be so stupid? How could we be so stupid? See, this is the unorthodox characteristic of alcoholism. We expect that we have the power to stay away from alcohol. If you're a real alcoholic, you don't. In the second step, it says, restore us to sanity. In the book, when it talks about sanity and insanity, it talks about picking up the first drink. Whatever goes through your mind before you pick up the first drink, that's a key problem. And there's a lot of treatment out there, and there's a lot of sponsors out there, and there's a lot of AA groups out there that want you to just do better. Well, if I could just do better, I would. I don't want to be. Who in the world would voluntarily accept the struggle of alcoholism for their lives? Who would want that? You know what we do. You remember what it was like. Who in the hell would voluntarily accept that in their life if they had any kind of access to power, choice, and control? We would have moved away from it long before we did. It's subtle. They call it the subtle form of insanity that precedes the first drink. That strange mental blank spot where you cannot access sound judgment, choice, power, or control. And you find yourself struck drunk. Okay, I used to hear in AA meetings, you never get struck drunk. Yeah, your slip always starts long before you take the first drink. Not for me, it didn't. I was going to an AA meeting. I'm going to an AA meeting. And boom, within 15 minutes, I'm drinking a gallon of vodka. I didn't want it. I drank that gallon of vodka to improve my sobriety. Do you understand how subtle, how cunning, how baffling, and how powerful the obsession of the mind is? Now, again, we're in real trouble if we're alcoholics. Let's go back to that sentence in the 12 and 12. Nothing but an act of divine providence can relieve us of this obsession. Let's jump to the 12th step. Anybody in here ever, you know, read the last chapter of a book to decide whether you want to read it or not? Okay, let's jump to the 12th step. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. All right, that is the goal. That's the end game. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. How I see alcoholism is it's very unorthodox because people do not understand that you don't have power, choice, and control. They think you're an asshole. Okay? A guy came up to me at a meeting on Tuesday night, my home group. And he came up, and listen, I hear this all the time. He came up and he goes, you know, I was listening to one of your tapes and you were explaining, I never heard that before. I know, I had never heard that explained that way. It made so much sense. You know, I've been going to these meetings and nobody's ever been telling me this stuff and nobody's ever been taking me through the steps and nobody's ever this and nobody's that. I've been drinking. And I said something to him that he just couldn't believe. I said, it's not your fault. It's not your fault you've been drunk and drinking this whole time. But it's going to be your fault now, because now you know what the solution is. You know the solution is the spiritual program of action in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Now you need to take responsibility. You were with people who didn't know what the hell to do with you. They thought you weren't trying, or they thought you weren't being honest. But I'm telling you, it was not your fault. And he's like, but I drank. See, everybody's been telling him it's his fault. And I said, it's not your fault. You were not exposed to the solution. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Nobody showed you what the path was. They were just telling you to go to meetings. Meetings don't treat alcoholism. Alcoholism isn't treated by meetings. Meetings are a human power. No human power can relieve us of our alcoholism. And I made him say it. I go, say it. It's not my fault. Come on, say it, say it. And finally he goes, okay, it's not my fault. And then he starts to smile. It's not my fault. You know, and he starts to get it because it wasn't his fault. It wasn't his fault. It says in the book Alcoholics Anonymous that we need to carry a message of depth and weight. You know, here's my phone number. Give me a call before you drink. It's not a message of depth and weight. Now, I start drinking again on this relapse. I don't even know if relapse is a good way to describe it because, you know, I hadn't recovered to be able to relapse. I was just staying dry. I was going to like 12 meetings a week. I was making a coffee. I was doing all this kind of stuff, and you know, I ended up slammed. I ended up in big trouble. I went back out for about 7 months. This was the most bleak, grim drinking. I mean, you know, come into AA for a while, go through treatment, go through outpatient, and then start drinking again. Oh boy, it's gonna be fun, you know? I mean, you know it's just so wrong, and you know it. It's like, this is so wrong, give me another. You know, it's a horrible contradiction that your soul has to try to get through. It was bleak. It was bleak, and I was just drinking to escape at this point in time. My emotional nature was torturous. My emotional state of mind, I was restless, irritable, and discontented on a good day. I was filled with guilt, remorse, shame, resentment, self-centered fear, self-pity would wash over me like a rain. At certain periods of time, the hideous four horsemen would come galloping through my life, you know, terror, frustration, bewilderment, despair. This was my emotional state in the last 7 months of my drinking on a constant basis. And the only thing I knew to get through this absolute torture was to get blackout drunk. I knew that, you know, being blackout drunk, you know, maybe I'd find just like 5 minutes of solace from the bondage of Chris. And I would do that, you know, and every single night I got just tongue chewing, knee walking, fall right out of the chair on the floor with a full glass of bourbon drunk, you know. And I'd wake up and I'd get up and I'd see the glass of bourbon. And if you ever made bourbon and Cokes with ice, there's some kind of nasty ass froth that'd be on that thing after the ice cubes had melted. I don't know where that came from. It looked like soap scum or something, you know, and you'd have to brush that off there, you know, to because you got to chug it because, you know, you got to get some sleep. It was just horrible. Now, it all culminates in Christmas 1989. Remember, I'm living at Mom's. Everybody goes to the homestead for Christmas, you know, it's like a tradition. So my brother and sister come in, nieces, nephews, you know, family animals, and, you know, there's presents under the tree and the Christmas carols on the stereo and the stockings are hung by the chimney with care. And I decide to take out a .38 caliber handgun and threaten all their lives because I had like a resentment about something, you know. What'd you say? You know, or so I'm gonna kill all of you. You know, and this wasn't the festive mood everybody was looking for. You know, it was Christmas, so they packed up their Christmas and they took it somewhere else. Thank you. You know, I come to and the presents are gone and I'd been on like a 5 day blackout. Okay, I'd been on a 5 day blackout, and I mean, I had never been on a blackout that long in my life. I didn't even know it was physically possible to be in a blackout for 5 days. But I looked at the calendar and I said, whoa, you know, it's the 28th. The last I remember is the 24th, you know? And And I came out of this blackout, and I was shattered. Anybody in here ever go through the delirium tremens? I mean, you know, the full-on, we've got some identification, the full-on convulsions and the hallucinations. There were maggots all over me, and there was animals, like, whoa, running around, and there was big things scratching on the house to get in. Okay, and there was marching bands playing. You know, whenever I'm sitting next to a newcomer and you can hear music somewhere, I'll go, I can hear it too. You know what I mean? Because I know. Where'd the marching band come from? But anyway, the worst part was I'm laying on the couch and I'm like, oh, like this. And a demon came out of the ceiling to eat my face. I'm talking a demon. This thing looked like one of those old monitors, like half bull with the big horns. Ah! And it came down out of the ceiling. And I remember lying there going, ah! It was horrible. And I screamed, God, help me. Now, let me talk a little bit about my relationship with God. I was raised in Basking Ridge, New Jersey, in a little Cape Cod house, mother, father, sister, brother, you know, Sunday school. I mean, the whole deal. We were Methodists. Methodists were basically, you know, it's kind of a benign religion. You don't have anybody hitting you or anything, you know. It's like kind of a take it or leave it kind of a thing. But here's the concept that I had gotten about God. There's a loving presence that's watching over me. And I believed that as a child. I really did. I believed that, you know, there was a force for good somewhere. And, you know, that force for good knows who I am and is kind of watching over me. And I believed that. Now, here's the problem. 3 days into my 12th birthday, my father had a massive heart attack at work and died. Went to work that morning, never came back. I never saw him again. Now, for someone who's just turned 12, that's really bad. You know what I mean? I mean, my whole world was shaken. If something like that could happen, I had to ask the question, why did God allow that to happen? Now, today I see things a lot differently. I don't see that, you know, God chose to have my father have a massive heart attack. I see it more like my father chose to smoke 35 packs of non-filtered cigarettes and, you know, gain a whole bunch of weight and have the flu and go to work anyway. You know, it had less to do with God than my father. But at that period of time, I believed that there was a loving presence that was looking down on me. And all of a sudden, I started to reassess that. Because if this kind of pain could happen to me, how much does this God love me? Now, without a father to really keep an eye on me and what I was doing, and my mother was off working, and she shut down emotionally for about a year. I mean, this was so devastating to her. She'd be like, you need any food? I mean, she just wasn't even able to pay attention to what was going on. So I started to hang out with kind of the wrong crowd. In my 12th year, that's when I first got drunk. It was either 12 or 13. I can't remember. But I started to go a little bit off this way. Now, the funny thing about this is I looked like a normal kid up to this point. Like, you would look at me and say, it's normal, 11-year-old, doing pretty well. No issues. You know, I looked that way. Inside, though, I had the spiritual condition of an alcoholic. Our book describes this really, really well. Bill Story describes his spiritual condition prior to drinking. There's a lot of information in the book that kind of paints the picture that we're spiritually not right. And you hear it a lot from a lot of speakers. You hear about a God-shaped hole. And what that is we're incomplete. Somehow we're spiritually incomplete, and we're looking sometimes desperately for things that we can complete ourselves with. And some of us do it with money, and some of us do it with sex, and some of us do it with booze, and some of us do it with drugs. We don't feel good inside, so we think we can find something out there that we can bring into our lives to make us feel better. That's typical of an alcoholic or anybody with substance abuse problems. Now, I felt that way my whole life. I felt like I was in the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong people. This had been a big mistake, you know, my life as it is right now. And, I started to head toward drugs and alcohol, and I started to do some juvenile delinquent type crimes with my friends because I started to hang around with the wrong friends. Because the wrong friends weren't judgmental. They never gave me a hard time. You know, did you study for that test? I mean, I'd never heard that from Weezer or Green Man. You know, they could care less. They just want to go out and have a six-pack of beer. So that's who, you know, I was hanging out with. Now, as I start shifting toward a questionable morality or doing what the hell I wanted to do when I wanted to do it, that conception I had of God, I was starting to find that inconvenient. God had become inconvenient. I don't need somebody sitting up there in heaven going, you did that. Oh, yeah, stole neighbor's furniture. Oh, okay. Contributing to the delinquency of minor women. You know, I don't need somebody keeping track of that stuff. So it was inconvenient, and I moved away from the concept of God. When that demon came out of that ceiling, I knew I was done. I mean, what was coming was, if that demon wasn't real, what was coming was a heart attack or something. I really was as close to feeling like I was going to die that I had ever been. And I cried out to that God that I had abandoned when I was 12 or 13 for help. I cried out with a willingness born of desperation to try to connect with that power, because I didn't see any other way to survive. I haven't had a drink since. You know, listen, I went to a million AA meetings. I did the rehabs, and I did the detoxes, and I did the outpatients. None of that ever helped. But I have to look back into my own past experience, and I have to ask myself, when I was as humble as you could be at that point in time when I cried out to God, and I haven't had a drink since. I have to see that as significant. Now, I told you that alcoholism is unorthodox. I'm going to tell you that the treatment for alcoholism is unorthodox. It's unorthodox. And I learned this. I learned this early on in my first year. I was an electrician. I was a bad electrician, you know, when I was drinking. But when I got sober, I stayed an electrician for a couple of years, you know, until I realized I probably shouldn't be doing that. But I was at work one day, and, you know, I didn't know any better. I'm in AA. I'm not drinking, you know, because they pass the beers around at lunch and say, I'm not drinking. I'm in AA. You know, finally, this one guy comes up to me and says, tell me a little bit about this AA. I know how bad you were. Tell me a little bit about the AA. How does it work? And I go, well, you know, I go uptown, we go down into a church basement, and I get a cup of coffee, and we sit down, and we say the Serenity Prayer. And after the Serenity Prayer, somebody opens the meeting, and somebody will raise their hand, they'll have a resentment, and they'll share their resentment. And then someone will go, I've got a resentment too, and everybody will share about their resentments, and they'll pass around a basket, and we'll put a dollar in it, and then at the end, we'll all get up, and we'll hold hands in a big circle, and we'll say the Lord's Prayer. The guy was like this. He was backing away from me. And I had to think, he's right. This is crazy. How does that have anything to do with drinking? The treatment for alcoholism is unorthodox. Okay, as a chronic low-bottom alcoholic, you can go to every professional there is. And I see treatment, and I see counseling, and I see therapies, and all that stuff as very, very good, as long as you understand its place in a continuum from active alcoholism to permanent recovery. That's the scope that we have to work with. Treatment is in the very beginning, and it's very, very helpful for separating somebody from alcohol and teaching them a little bit about the illness. All right, but it's not the panacea for anything. You can go to the absolute best treatment people in the world, and if you don't live life along spiritual lines in a certain way, you're going to end up drunk. And you might have been going to the professor of psychiatry at Harvard, and you're not going to get sober, and then you'll walk into an AA meeting, and there'll be a plumber named Harry who'll come up to you and say, "Kid, you're going to come over my house on Tuesday night, and we're going to steps. And Harry will get you sober. All right. It's an unorthodox treatment for alcoholism. Who in the world would think writing out the whole Megillah in steps 4, all your resentments, all the harms to others, all your fears, and then sharing them with somebody, that doesn't make any sense, okay? Paying the money back, flying all over the country, going back to the judge and saying, "I'm here," you know? Wait a minute, that doesn't compute. It's an unorthodox treatment process. And for us to, many times, for us to engage in this recovery process, we have to have the absolute crap kicked out of us. Because we're just not going to waltz in and do the steps. We'll do anything we can possibly do to avoid the steps. Because they don't look like they're going to work. Number two, they're really scary and I'll look stupid. You know what I mean? Number three, they don't even know I robbed them. It wouldn't make any sense to pay them back. I mean, you can go on and on. Pray and meditate. You know, you can go on and on, and you can look at these things and you can say, this just doesn't make any sense. Where's the step? Where's the step with the money? That's what I really need. Where's the step? Where's the step that'll make all the babes like me? You know, I mean, none of these steps have anything to do with what I think I need. They just don't look like they're going to work. Now, remember I told you we're going to jump to the last chapter, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. That's the end game. There's resistance in every one of us to this stuff, okay? When I first was exposed to the step process, it was not from meetings. I was going to maybe a half a dozen meetings in the Somerset County area in the late 80s and early 90s. And I didn't hear anybody talking about the mechanics, the actual implementation of the steps. I would go to step meetings, and what I would hear is, I would hear a lot about people sharing about the step, a little bit of philosophy about the step. You know, we would read the step, and we would think about the step, but there was rarely anybody that ever did them. And forever, I would hear things like this. We'd be reading the ninth step, and somebody would raise their hand and share, and they'd say something like, "Well, I haven't done this step formally, but I'm going to take the meeting hostage for the next 10 minutes and give you my crap opinion on what I think this step might mean," you know? And that's what you would hear in the step meetings. And if somebody made the mistake of walking in and raising their hand and saying, "I just got back from California. I made 6 amends out there. I'd like to talk to you about my experience." People would go, "Who the hell is this guy?" You know what I mean? That's what was going on in the meetings that I was going to. Now, I was exposed to the recovery process from a series of tapes, and thank God I did. Now, any truth, there's a place in the chapter Working with Others where Bill Wilson says, if you've disturbed somebody about their alcoholism, this is all to the good. Now, he believed, because they had a lot of experience working with others. They had 4 or 5 years hardcore going to the hospital, going to the drunk tanks, going to the insane asylums, working with hopeless alcoholics. I mean, the institutionalized hopeless alcoholics. They, every night they were looking for him. So they had a lot of experience with this. And he understood that if you disturb an alcoholic about their alcoholism, it's all to the good. And these tapes that I listened to that talked about a big book recovery process disturbed me. My first thought was, oh, who the hell are you guys? These guys think they are? This ain't how we do it in New Jersey. You know, that's like my first reaction. I was upset because they made me feel small. They made me feel like I wasn't doing it right. And I was going to 12 meetings a week, and I was a coffee maker over here, and a treasurer here, and a secretary here, and I was driving the boobies from the hatch to the meeting here, and I was going to the diner. You know, I made all my friends. I was going to AA dances. I mean, how much more do you want? You know, how brutal is that? Oh, listen, I've got issues with like dancing, okay, and it goes back to childhood trauma. Let me explain this. Fourth grade, they decide for gym class to have square dancing. Okay? Does anybody remember square dancing? Do-si-do your partner? Okay? Now, what they would do is they would line up all the men on one side of the gym and all the women on the other side of the gym, and you'd just be standing there like an idiot, and they'd blow the whistle. And when they blew the whistle, you'd have to run across the dance floor like this and then ask somebody to dance. Ah! You know, they have no idea the damage they were doing to, like, pre-alcoholics with this, you know? The therapists are still making money on this. You know, so going to a sober dance, you know, that was the ultimate, you know, for me. Yeah, okay, I'll go. Oh, I mean, you give me a half a gallon of bourbon, and I'm dancing. You know what I mean? There's dancing lessons in that bourbon. You ask me to do it sober, and there's a problem. Now I'm Mr. AA. I'm the fellowship monk, okay? I am doing it. I'm doing everything. Nobody is busier than me, and they're patting me on the head. Chris, you're doing a good job. Pat, 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 you know? And I'd be like, yeah, you know? And here's the thing. I was freaking dying inside. I was dying inside. None of that shame, guilt, remorse, self-centered fear, depression, anxiety, resentments, none of that stuff was going away because I was going to meetings, because meetings don't treat that stuff. Meetings are a place where we get together and we mutually support ourselves through a spiritual program of action. Now, these are some of the things that I learned. I believe that in the first 15 years of Alcoholics Anonymous, we had a program with a support fellowship. Okay, everybody was about the steps. Everybody was about the steps. You would go and you would qualify somebody in a 12-step call. You'd tell them about your drinking. You'd get them to tell you about theirs. And then you'd talk about how you went through the steps to recover from alcoholism. And if they wanted to go through the steps with you, you brought them in. If they didn't, you said goodbye. You didn't bring them to a meeting. If they were somewhere in the steps, you know, on amends, or if they've done their fifth step, then maybe you'll bring them to a meeting. There was bouncers at meetings. They would qualify you. Don't let the door hit you in the ass if you're not willing to go pay the money back. There was a program with a support fellowship. Somewhere along the line, you know, Tradition 3 came along. You know, AA was growing so fast, the newcomers were you know, outnumbering the old timers like crazy. There's a couple of magazine articles that came out where the AA population went from like 2,000 to 10,000 in like a month. They just couldn't keep up. And what happened was somewhere along the line it became a fellowship with a maybe support program. Like maybe you'll find a sponsor that'll take you through the steps. Now this is all the stuff that I'm learning from these tapes, and I am upset. I'm really upset because, number one, they're telling me I'm doing it wrong. Number two, I've never heard any of this stuff before, but the truth will haunt you when you hear it. When somebody points right between your eyes and hits you right in the head with truth, you're going to be upset about it, but you're going to have to deal with it. You're going to have to somehow come to a rationalization about that truth. And I knew I was in big trouble. I knew I was getting close to a drink because emotionally I couldn't take it anymore. And I was doing as much AA as I could. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. I believe that I was spiritually insane. I believe I was spiritually asleep. Having had a spiritual awakening would mean that my spirit was asleep. I was walking around spiritually asleep. Now, what happens in step two basically is through surrender in step one, through understanding that I'm defeated. Who among us wishes to admit complete defeat? I'm at a point where I'm ready to admit complete defeat. There's only one other option. The book talks about it. Die an alcoholic death, live along spiritual lines. Those are your two alternatives if you're a real alcoholic, if you're a chronic alcohol-dependent individual who cannot separate from alcohol on their own unaided will. You've got two alternatives. Live life along spiritual lines, die an alcoholic death. Now, I've worked with enough newcomers to know when I present them with that, they do this. What kind of alcoholic death? Because it's not an easy alternative to face. Who wants to face that kind of alternative? Now, once you've gotten on the other side of it, once you've experienced the steps, once you've had the spiritual awakening, you are what upsets every newcomer when they hear it. You're a grateful alcoholic because you're grateful that you've had a spiritual awakening, that you're not asleep walking around like a dead man anymore. That you know you're at a new level of life. But when you're faced with that, you're like, you know, you can't see that spirituality is going to be your answer. It doesn't make any sense. Now, I was lucky enough to have listened to those tapes and then to have gotten in a whole bunch of trouble in early recovery. You ever been in the barrel? You ever have a sober bottom? You know, where a number of things happen and, you know, like two or three really bad things happen and you're sitting there like, I'm sober, you know, and you just kind of can't take it. Well, that happened to me. And I was at a point where I was either going to do one of three things. One of them was put a bullet in my head. The other was get drunk and say, the hell with all this. I can't do it. It's not going to work for me. And number three was to really grab out for that spiritual solution. As the book says, like the dying, grasp a life preserver. Think about this. You've fallen off a boat in the middle of the ocean and somebody throws out a life preserver. You're going for that life preserver. That's how I have to act, going for those steps. Now, my first run through, how I did it was listening to the tapes, having the big book open, and having a pad and pencil. And I did kind of the best I could. You know, when I look back on it, I probably wouldn't find anything like what I did acceptable to me if I was working with somebody today. But I can guide them. You know, I didn't really have a guide. I had a set of tapes. And I started to go through these tapes. I became willing to go through these steps to the best of my ability. And another thing I learned is the absolute beauty and perfection of the AA program. What I do for a living today, bizarrely enough, is I'm a media director for a company, and what I do is I go around and I interview treatment professionals. Just in the last week, I interviewed the president of the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Addiction. I interviewed the executive director of Faces and Voices of Recovery. I interviewed the person who is in charge of the national association that goes around and accredits treatment centers and gives them audits. I mean, you know, that's just in the last week. I really am involved with treatment centers, and I understand what they're doing, and I absolutely support them. The thing is when I look at what alcoholism is, what addictive illness is it's much too aggressive to be cured by any of those processes. It's a chronic spiritual physical condition, alcoholism. And it requires not only the third step commitment to be all in, but it requires that commitment almost on a daily basis. I came to understand in the beginning, step two, that my sponsors, these tapes, the process, the meetings, everything put together is a power greater than myself. And I wasn't really counting on the Father of Light, like Bill Wilson would describe it. That was not my conception of God. I still had the conception of God where, you know, there's a throne and a guy with a staff and a white beard, you know, who's all powerful and who's, you know, keeping track of all the sins that I was, you know, I still kind of had that type of deity in my mind. So I used Alcoholics Anonymous and I used my sponsor and I used everything I possibly could as my higher power. But that couldn't last long. There's a great line in Dr. Bob's Nightmare. Actually, knowing that Dr. Bob was a failing proctologist, the story really should be Dr. Bob's patient's nightmare, you know, because there was a joke that would go around in the hospital that if you go to Dr. Bob Smith, you could lose your ass, and they weren't kidding, you know, but in his story, he goes, if you don't believe in God, I feel sorry for you. Why does he feel sorry for you? Do you know why he feels sorry for you? Because you're going to die. That's why. If you don't believe in God, you're going to die. Now, in AA, we don't tell you what kind of a God to believe in. That's your business. There's a couple of sins I think that you can commit in Alcoholics Anonymous today. One of them is, you know, being a sexual predator and, you know, grabbing the newer members, you know, and engaging them in whatever you have to engage them in, you know, before they get on their feet. I think that's a sin. Excuse me. I think the other sin is interfering with someone being able to develop their own conception of God. I think it has to be personal, and I think we really have to feel it at a deep level, so people interfering with it can be a problem. Is anybody in here a Star Trek fan? The original series, okay? You remember what the prime directive was? Don't mess with the... All right, if Captain Kirk landed on some planet and they were back there and all they were using was like sledges and axes, they hadn't moved forward with technology, you don't hand them a laser gun. You know, they're not going to be ready for it. They're not going to be able to deal with it. They need to deal at their own pace. So in Alcoholics Anonymous, we need to remember the prime directive. Never try to shove your concept of God down somebody else's throat. But what you can tell them is if they don't get with God, they're going to die. Because that's what our book says. So in step two, it was a process for me. In the spiritual appendix in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, these spiritual awakenings have happened to us at different ways. There's the sudden and profound spiritual awakening, which you got to understand, they did the steps in a matter of days in the first 15 years. You bring somebody over to your house, he's writing a four-step, you get him back, you finish up his ninth step, he's off making amends, he's done with the steps in a week. That's the way they did it in the first 15 years. Nowadays, we've got 12 and 12 meetings where every week there's a step and we can read the step and it takes 3 months. I don't know where that came from. But we don't do it like that anymore, unfortunately. It also talks about the spiritual awakening of the educational variety. Happens slowly over the course of time with a bunch of work. And that's how it happened with me. I did not have somebody bringing me over to my house, taking me through the steps, you know, in my first week of sobriety. I struggled around for about a year wanting to kill myself before I even found these tapes. Now, the spiritual awakening, you know, what is that? Coming, you know, one of the great things I used to hear in AA was, kid, don't make any major decisions in your first year. Well, the spiritual awakening itself is a rearrangement of your thoughts and actions. So completely think completely different and completely act completely different, but no major changes. The spiritual awakening is what it sounds like. You're awakening spiritually. There was always an intuitive capacity in me. I knew right from wrong almost from like 2 years old. I knew if something was going to be bad and I knew if something was going to be good. I believe that there's a God-given capacity in us to align ourselves spiritually. And when we do that, that God-shaped hole that we have gets filled with spirituality or filled with God. If we go left and try to just rape, rob, pillage, and steal, to get what we want, what's going to happen is that hole is going to get bigger. So the steps awakened me to the intuitive capacity that I've always had that allows me to line up with spirituality. All of this with God's help. Living life along spiritual lines, you get spiritual experiences. Doing esteemable acts, you build self-esteem. Act in an honest way, and people will act in an honest way with you. These are all principles that go back 4,000 years that we have found inconvenient. So much of recovery we could have learned if we paid attention in kindergarten. You know what I mean? Don't steal, don't hit. You know, don't lie, don't be a tattletale. I mean, these are all things that, you know, we've been guilty of as alcoholics like crazy. So the spiritual awakening allow us to access the power to start living along spiritual lines. In step three, I need to make a decision. Am I in or am I out? In the old days, they'd be sitting with a prospect. They called somebody a prospect until they had agreed to go through the steps. Once they started to go through the steps, they were called a protege or a friend. That's the terminology that the Big Book uses. Sponsorship came later, and Bill would know more about this than I do, but I think it had to do with, everybody went to the hospital in the early days so that they could all 12-step them, all the members could go in and talk to them. And to get into the hospital, you needed somebody from AA to sponsor you into the hospital. That's where I think it came from. Pigeons, babies, pukes. I'm not a big fan of calling anybody that's walking hand in hand down the spiritual highway with me, you know, calling them a degrading name. Look, alcohol degraded me enough. I don't need somebody degrading me. But that's what would happen. And so you would do a third step. You would make your third step demonstration. This is how Dr. Bob would do it. He'd usually have some of his boys around. And you'd be in his office and he'd go, okay, kid, get down on your knees. And you'd have to get down on your knees and you'd have to say a bunch of prayers. He'd tell you the prayers to say. And if you weren't sincere, he'd make you do it again. Now, I don't know that that's how we have to do the third step. But it needs to be a significant demonstration. It needs to be followed by a commitment. You know the difference between a decision and a commitment? My friend Joe Hawk would tell this all the time, and I'm going to tell it because I like the way I tell it. Chicken and a pig walking down the street one day together, and they see a sign, and the sign says, help feed the poor. And the chicken goes to the pig, hey, that sounds like a great idea. Let's help feed the poor. And the pig goes, well, what do you propose? And the chicken goes, we'll feed them ham and eggs. And the pig looks down at the chicken and he goes, that's easy for you to say. For you, it's just a simple decision to lay a couple eggs. For me, it's a life commitment. I have to give my life to be able to do that. Well, that's the difference between a decision and the commitment that needs to follow. You know what the commitment is that you need? The beginning of the commitment is when you get up off your knees from the third step prayer, it's to start writing a fourth step right away. It says immediately. It doesn't say, you know, after you come back from vacation. It says immediately. There's power in following directions. I don't know what it is. It may be coincidental. I have no idea. But there's power in actually following the instructions in the book. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. We've been inundated in Alcoholics Anonymous in the last 30 years from people coming out of treatment. Inundated. I've told you that there are periods of time where more newcomers are coming in and the old timers, the experienced AAs, just don't have enough time to keep up with all of them, all right? There's been periods of time like that. A lot of the things that you hear in treatment is appropriate for a treatment modality. I think it would be appropriate for you to take what you need and leave the rest in a treatment process. If you try it in Alcoholics Anonymous, you'll probably die. So there's a lot of things that came from treatment and made their way into AA and became almost, you know, AA slang that don't belong here. You know, I'm not somebody who throws around slogans with that kind of ease, because I got to tell you, easy never did nothing. You know what I mean? And first things first, I always did fourth things first. You know, they never resonated with me. Now, if they've resonated with you, I think that every single tool you can have in your arsenal is good. But if you go up to a newcomer and you say, oh, man, I'm really struggling. You know, I don't know if I'm going to make it. Kid, you just need to hang on. Well, how do I hang on? Kid, you gotta let go. You know, you gotta understand we're crazy enough without stuff like that being thrown at us. Now, steps 1, 2, and 3. Powerlessness is powerlessness. You wanna do a really good guided meditation? You know, maybe sometime tonight or Sunday. Do a guided meditation and ask yourself about your truth as far as powerlessness is concerned. This is how important the book Alcoholics Anonymous thinks it is. If you're not sure, you have the mental obsession that you go back to drink even though you don't want to. The book says, try staying away from booze for a year. Don't go to meetings. Don't go to church. Don't pray. Don't do nothing. Just try to stay away from alcohol for a year on your own. If you're alcoholic, you're probably not going to make it. Now, if you're not sure that you have the physical craving, that allergy to alcohol, the book tells you try some controlled drinking. You're supposed to try some controlled drinking. That's what the book tells you to do. It's not my opinion. based on the facts that they give you in the book prior to asking you to do that. Because they believe the true knowledge of your condition is worth more than a relapse and losing a couple of months or a couple of years. The true nature of your malady is important. You need to understand your first step truth to be able to come to believe that divine providence is the only thing that can relieve you of your alcoholism, and then make the decision to go after that divine providence. If those things aren't set properly in place, you'll become meeting dependent at best. One of those cranky people who's been going to meetings 100 years and just, you know, tailgating somebody, you know, on the way to the meeting to go talk about, I got to share on serenity. Get out of my way. That's at best. At worst, you're going to be like the 90% of the people that can't stay here for 5 years. You can't stay here for 5 years. You can't keep coming because you just can't keep coming. How many people have you seen run through here? Anybody in here with over 10, 20 years? How many people have you seen come through this mill? All right. I wish they would take pictures like every week of the home group and you could go back and look. Oh, where's he? Oh, he's gone. We lose 90% of the people in like 5 or 10 years because they can't stay here, because without a spiritual program of action, you don't have the power to stay here. You just can't stand it after a while and you disappear. Anyway, this is only my opinion on the first three steps. I do not speak for AA as a whole, even though I sometimes believe I do. We're going to end tonight. We're going to be back here at 9 o'clock in the morning. Rich is going to pick up in the morning with 4 through 9. I'm going to do my bastardized version of 4 through 9, and then we're going to have the unbelievable pleasure of watching Doug do his thing. You will not want to miss that. Thanks for having me here.